Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so we shall continue this morning, and we'll continue working on right effort and having continued to look at ways of practicing right effort. And the reason why I'm emphasizing right effort so much once again is because this is a thing that leads up to meditation practice. So if you get the right effort right, then there's a much bigger chance of actually having success in meditation afterwards. So this is why I want to emphasize this. This couple of suttas today are quite simple suttas, and they're quite straightforward. And often I have to admit I like the simple suttas, because the simple suttas, they give an easy message. It's easy to follow. There's usually very little difficulty in interpretation. We can understand them quite easily. So sometimes it's very handy to have a few simple suttas that you can apply in your ordinary life to improve the practice, so to speak. So the first one of these is called removing resentment. In other words, removing anger or ill will is basically what this is about. So it goes as follows. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friends bhikkhus. Friend, those bhikkhus replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this. And the first thing which is interesting here is, of course, that in those days, the bhikkhus addressed each other as friend, avuso. And even if somebody was more senior, they actually called each other by avuso. These days, if a monk is more senior, you normally call the monk bante. But in those days, there was more kind of almost equality in the sangha. And the only person who was called bante was the Buddha himself. Everybody else were just on friendly terms. So it looks like the sangha has become more kind of hierarchical and more kind of vertical in a sense over the centuries after the passing away of the Buddha. Anyway, friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What five? Here, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment toward such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should remove resentment toward such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment toward such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind from time to time. One should also remove resentment toward such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, a placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So here, this is just the summary of the sutta. You can see how the Buddha was like a very good teacher, just like people teach today, an experienced teacher. He knows that you summarize the subject first. This is actually Venerable Sariputta, but it's the same with the Buddha as well. You summarize it, then you give the exposition, and then you give a summary at the end, right? It's like a very, the right way of teaching, essentially, to be able to impart information as good as possible. And the idea, the reason you have five categories here, is not so much that these are, five categories of people. These categories include all people. There's nothing really left out from this. This is from the most impure person to the most pure person are included in these categories. And the reason it's divided up is simply that your strategy for removing anger will vary depending on the type of person you are dealing with. So everybody is really included here. And this is an important point, so that there isn't anybody to whom You know, you cannot remove anger. There's always a possibility. Even the worst people in the world, the kind of the Hitlers and the, you know, the Pol Pots of the world, you can still remove anger towards them. So, then how do we do this? And this is the next part here. And I will explain some of these little, slightly obscure words here further on as we go down. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robe-wearing bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. And this is, you know, the typical thing of human beings. You will find it's very easy. Most people have some flaws, and many people, particularly good people who practice the Buddhist path, they will also have many good qualities. So often it is about where you attend. If your mind is inclined towards fault-finding or negativity, you will tend to see the bad things. But if your mind is inclined towards friendliness and metta, you will tend to see the good things. So this is a way of learning how to develop the mind in that friendliness, in that kindness, and move away from the negativity and the fault-finding. And this is so important, such an important thing to do. And it isn't that difficult. It isn't that difficult because in many people around us there are definitely good qualities. And it's very strange how the mind can turn from being negative to being positive very quickly if you learn to just focus differently like that. It's not such a difficult thing to do. And you may ask, is it just about verbal behavior or bodily behavior? I think you can expand this principle to basically say any aspect of the person that is beautiful is here what you should focus on, and move the attention away from any aspect that is not beautiful. It is interesting, though, however, that Venerable Sariputta makes this distinction between action and bodily action and verbal action. It's interesting, and maybe it is the case that people tend to somehow, you know, maybe their bad behavior tends to sort of accumulate in a certain area in speech or in, you know, by body or whatever. But what it shows, I think, is that you have to have a kind of a large part of the person that has to be good for you to be able to focus properly on it. It cannot just be a very, very small thing. It helps if it is a large area. So that bodily action, of course, covers a fairly broad area, right? So you focus on that large area, and then it's quite easy to see. So that is then how you change your perception of somebody else, how you can actually see them differently, just by focusing in the right way. And sometimes people think, oh, but you have to be realistic, you know, you have to see the world as it actually is, you know, the person is like that, you can't just focus on the good qualities, it's like denying the bad side of the person. But the point is that there isn't really any clear reality, right? We are all following our defilements, we're all following our predispositions, our habits. There isn't any neutral ground, this is exactly the way it is. So we're always choosing anyway. We're choosing according to our own conditioning. So because we are choosing anyway, you might as well choose something good rather than choose something bad. There isn't, in these kind of things, there isn't really any absolute truth. We don't know what that absolute truth is anyway. So we choose the good simply because it leads you in the right direction on the path. Okay, so that is the first one with that simile there of just like a robe. You tear off the bad parts of the robe, of the cloth, and then you keep the good one. This is kind of the old tradition in the old days, and you still see it sometimes now of monks just wearing a rag robe, all bits and pieces all over her. And it's quite nice actually to do that. It sort of feels quite good, not wearing any kind of luxury clothes for sure, which is quite nice. Sometimes, even in, you know, of course in lay life, people focus a lot on clothes, what they wear is very important. So sometimes you find the same in monastic life. You find monks and nuns focusing on the kind of robe they have, the kind of material, the quality, and all these kind of things. And it somehow misses the point of the monastic life. I will talk a little bit more about that later on, because it comes up afterwards. Okay, so the second person here. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. So here it's the opposite case, and you can see here what you go to this pond, you clear away all the algae, all the bad stuff, and then you drink the water with your cupped hands, right? So you feel a sense of satisfaction. You drink the water. This is part of the idea here of purifying yourself. When you see the good side in somebody else, you feel a sense of satisfaction inside. You feel better, just like somebody drinking the water and quenching their thirst. Okay, number three. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there is a little water in the puddle. Then a person might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours and suck it up like a cow and depart. And then he gets down on all fours, sucks up the water like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. On that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Okay, so here they talk about a person who gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. And the opening of the mind here, the Pali word for that is the cetaso vivadana. And vivadana is like the opposite of nivadana. Nivadana are the obstructions. So an opening is something which is like lack of obstructions, essentially. So what we are talking about here is somebody whose mind becomes pure sometimes. And, you know, like the mind that can attain samadhi, basically. So here is somebody that who, despite their bodily conduct, despite the bad verbal conduct, still sometimes gains a sense of freedom in the mind, a lack of obstructions in the mind. And placidity of the mind, I can't remember right now what the Pali is for that one, probably pasada or something like that, which means like placidity or, you know, evenness, the calm of the mind. That is a similar kind of term, which also refers to samadhi, or the mind before samadhi, when it is peaceful and there's no obstructions there. So here, you might wonder, how is it possible that somebody who has impure actions can get good mind states like this? We always talk in Buddhism about you have to act in a pure way. When you act in a pure way, then your mind becomes pure. So how come this person here actually does all these impure things and still he has a mind that is pure occasionally? And the reason for that is simply because in the past he must have done something right, and he's basically living off his past karma. That is what's happening here. So he still has, there's some goodness from the past that allows him to have a pure mind. But if he continues acting with bad verbal behavior, bad bodily behavior, then eventually he will lose that purity of the mind as well. He's basically dragging himself down, but at this point he hasn't gone down far enough, so he still gets that good mind state every now and again. So we should focus on that mind state that he gets every now and again. How do you know that somebody has a good mind state? How do you know that somebody has this cetasovivarana, the lack of obstructions in the mind? How can we know that? And the way you know that is basically when you have lived with somebody for a long time, particularly, you know their character, right? You know from external appearance whether they sometimes are peaceful, whether they sometimes are calm, and you know roughly what their mind state is like. This is actually one of the ways that the Buddha talks about in one of the ways of reading somebody's mind, is just to look at somebody's behavior. And from looking at the behavior, you can be fairly certain about the mind state behind that. So this is, it sounds almost strange, but actually, we do this all the time, right? We say, this person is angry. You can't read their mind, but you tell from external signs, right? This person is agitated. Again, you tell from external signs. So we can tell a lot about somebody's mind just by looking at them. So this is how you do that. And then you have this nice simile. Again, the person who is oppressed by heat, just like in the previous one, weary, thirsty, and parched. This is like you have a fault-finding mind, right? If you have a fault-finding mind, you see the fault in somebody else. This is like being oppressed, pressed by the heat. You're weary, tired, thirsty, etc. And then you see the opportunity to get rid of that fault-finding mind. You find a small puddle. You find a tiny little area of this person that is beautiful. And that is the puddle, this small little area. Sometimes he gets a peaceful mind. And then you focus on that. But you have to be very careful because it's only a very narrow area. So it's very easy for the fault-finding mind to grasp hold of the speech, to grasp hold of the bad bodily behavior. So you have to narrow your focus very narrowly. And that's why you have to be so careful, and you have to, as it says here, lay down on all fours and kind of suck up the water from this puddle, just like a cow, it says here. And so it shows you have to be, if you're not careful, the mind will go back to the fault-finding and see the bad verbal behavior again. So it's a very small opportunity. And this is, of course, more difficult because there is only that small area there which you can focus on. And then, when you do that, that is when you abandon that resentment towards that person. This is the third way of abandoning the resentment. Okay, so the next one. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards a person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, and gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant, and he would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man may not encounter calamity and disaster right here. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this venerable one abandon his bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, he will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here we have this really dodgy character who does all kind of dodgy things. And of course, there are people like that in the world. So we have to take those into account as well. So when somebody is really, not a very good person, it is very easy to get upset with people like that. Very easy, because you cannot really see anything good in them. And this then is the way to deal with a person like that. And it's a very, I find the similes of the Buddha so beautiful. And this is how then you should think about that person. You should think about it as someone who is ill, somebody who is sick, somebody who isn't really themselves, right? They are in a difficult position. And the reason why they are sick is because, obviously, they don't understand what they are doing to themselves. And this is always the point. When somebody is bad, somebody does bad things, the person they hurt more than anyone else is, of course, themselves, right? You know those famous, there's some suttas about the power of generosity and the power of merit. And it says that if you give something, it repays itself many, many, many times over, 1,000 times over, 100,000 times over, depending on the kind of generosity, etc. And the same is true for the negative karma as well. It tends to repay in a negative way many, many times over, right? So we may reap a little bit of trouble from that person, but they themselves reap it far, far more than anyone else. So again, this is the way of reflecting. They are sick, they are ill, they are deluded. They don't understand how the world operates. And because of that, the only reasonable thing to do is to have compassion for them. Because they have a serious problem, basically. So you see this person, it's like a person traveling along the road, right? They are sick, they are ill, and they don't have any suitable food or medicine. This is perhaps a bit like the Buddhist teachings, perhaps. You know, the teachings is like a nourishment for the spiritual life, to living in a good way. So they don't have a proper teacher. They don't have anybody to look after them. This again is the idea of the sarana. The sarana is a refuge. So the Buddha is like a person who looks after us, right? Who has compassion for us and says, this is the way to practice, this is not the way to practice. So you have somebody who is, in a sense, looking after you. But this person doesn't have that. He doesn't have a good teacher, he doesn't have the Dhamma, he doesn't have a refuge, he doesn't have anything at all. So these are parts, the way I think this simile should be reasonably understood. He doesn't get to meet the leader of the village district. The leader is, of course, a powerful person who is able to help him out, right? So then, when you see that, when you see this poor person traveling along, then you have a sense of compassion and sympathy instead. So again, you know, it is all about focus. If you focus on poor me, this person is disturbing my life, if you focus on yourself, that is when ill will arises. But if instead of focusing on yourself, you actually consider the other person instead, then compassion arises. So how can you avoid focusing on yourself? It is so natural for us to focus on ourselves, because we feel the pain, right? So it's very normal to focus. It's not bad as such, but it's obviously very normal to focus on your own pain and your own problems. So how can we avoid that? And it's very important to, you know, learn some skillful techniques to take away this kind of self-concern, to be so self-centered in a sense, and instead learn to focus in a different way. And one of the very simple ways of not focusing on ourselves is simply to remind ourselves that this is the way the world is. The world always is going to throw in our way difficult people, difficult situations. It's going to throw bad speech our way. We're going to have to bear up with all these kind of things. And because the world is this way, it's not something we can change, right? And if you can't change it, if this is the way it is, what's the point of getting angry? Anger usually arises because we think we can change something. You know, this person should be different, it shouldn't be like that. I'm going to tell them off to teach them a lesson or whatever. But actually, we can tell off as many people as we like, and the world is still going to be the same. It is impossible to change the world. The world is just too big, there's too many things happening, there's too much conditioning. So when you realize that, you say, okay, I will have to accept this. I can't change it. So no point in getting angry. Instead, I will accept it as it is. And then, when you don't focus on your own pain anymore, or you accept the pain, this is part and parcel, this is what it means to be human, you have to accept this kind of pain in your life, there's no way around it, then you can have a sense of peace, even in difficult situations. Not need to get angry anymore. It's fine. This is just the way things are. And then, once you have taken away that self-concern, then you can put your concern on the other person instead. And you can say, wow, this person is in a very bad state, and have a sense of compassion for them. May they, as it says here, change their behavior so they don't reap the terrible results of bad behavior in the future. So, that there you are. So that is the fourth way, you know, how to see positively even a person who is really kind of a real scallywag, as they like to say. Okay, so then the last one. This is the inspiring person. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks, and a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and then, after coming out, he would sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. So here again, you see, you're coming there. There is heat. You are weary. You are thirsty. In other words, this shows you a person who is under the sway of the defilements. Right? This is a person who has some sort of suffering in their life. And then you come to this pond, this beautiful pond with beautiful clean water, with all these kind of trees around, with smooth banks. And this is like the beautiful person, right? So if you have all these defilements, and you come to a person with lots of beautiful qualities, it's very easy to let go of the defilements. And you feel at ease, and you feel relaxed in the presence. Just like a person who is oppressed in this way, they come to a beautiful pond, they can relieve their oppression. In the same way, you can relieve the oppression of the defilement sometimes in the presence of a good person. Why? Because it's so easy to see the good qualities, right? So, you drink in those good qualities, and then you abandon the defilements through the negative states through doing that. And this is... It's interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes we do have resentment even towards good people. Sometimes we find people who are very good. You read the suttas and you read about arahants at the time of the Buddha. And even those arahants would sometimes receive abuse and people who have ill will towards them. And this is the problem in life. The problem in life is often the anger we have often has got nothing to do with the other person. It's got everything to do with us. So even if the other person doesn't deserve the anger, because of our own conditioning, we still do have anger sometimes. So we have to be very careful with that. The ill will, the resentment, all these kind of things. Sometimes it's actually unfair, and still it happens. So that is why we need to be careful in those cases to remind ourselves, even with situations where people are very pure and have a very beautiful behavior, still we need to remind ourselves, actually, yes, there is all these beautiful things here. There's no need to be angry. Why am I getting angry? Maybe it is just my own silliness in getting angry here. And it's okay to accept that we are silly. Everybody is silly every now and again. We don't have to take ourselves so seriously to think that we are never make mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes. And then when we accept that we make mistakes, then we can correct them and we can actually grow in the Dhamma. So that's why it says here at the end, friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. This is what I was talking about before, about why the Buddha and why an Arahant is so important in the world. Because when you see people like that, it inspires confidence. You feel, wow, this really is worthy of confidence. And it gives you impetus to practicing the path. So, one interesting word here, this confidence in every way, I believe the word here is Samantapasadika. And those of you who are monks, I'm sure will recognize that word straight away, the Samantapasadika being the commentary on the Vinaya. So that is where that word presumably comes from. This is the only place, as far as I know, in the whole of the suttas where that word actually occurs. So that is probably where the Venerable Buddhaghosa took that word from, the Samantapasadika, the person who inspires confidence in every way. So he, I think Buddhaghosa took that to mean that you practice the Vinaya properly. That's why he probably wrote that commentary. But of course, here it is more about general behavior rather than just purely Vinaya issues. Okay, these friends are the five ways of removing resentment by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment toward whomever it has arisen. So important word that is word entirely. It's not just a little bit, you actually remove it completely in this way. So, there you are, very practical sutta, very down to earth, very applicable, I think, for everybody. And as I said before, I think these kind of suttas are very, very useful because they bring us down to the real practice of Buddhism. So, now, again, so we are still working on this idea of removing the defilements and right effort. And now I want to kind of expand this a little bit and take into account also other ways of removing defilements. And the next sutta is one of my favorite suttas in the Sanghita Nikaya. That's why I have included it here, simply because I like it. It's always nice to read something you feel inspired by, because then you know it's more fun to read it for me as well. So I like this one. This is basically about the recollection of death. And the recollection of death is a very important part of the Buddha's teachings. He talks about, it's called in Pali, it's called Maranasati, or it's called Maranasanya. Maranasati means recollection of death. Maranasanya means perception of death. I think they are largely interchangeable. They mean roughly the same thing here. And it is a very important part of the Buddha's teaching here. You find the Maranasanya, Maranasati, so many places in the suttas. And the Buddha praises it as one of those things that one should be doing a lot to establish this very strongly. And he says that it is not just for monastics. He specifically says that this type of contemplation is also for lay followers as well, monastics and lay followers. So it is very powerful. And the thing about Maranasati, it tends to clarify what is important in life, right? If you're going to die, what are you going to do? Are you going to get upset and angry? Are you going to desire a lot of things? What's the purpose of desiring stuff if you're going to die anyway? You're not going to think about the new car you're going to buy or the new house you're going to build if you're going to die tomorrow, right? It's pointless. So it tends to kind of take away all that things that actually are, you know, all those worldly things that are uncertain anyway. It gets rid of all that. Or if you are on your deathbed, are you going to get angry with the people around you? That's the last thing you do on your deathbed. On your deathbed, you want to be peaceful, right? You don't care anymore what people say because you're going to die anyway. You're going to be off and they will be left behind you. So if people do the wrong things, you have a sense of compassion for them, sympathy. You don't get angry when you're about to die. So this death contemplation is can be very, very powerful and very useful to set our priorities right, to make sure that we act in the way that is appropriate according to the Buddha's teachings. So let us see what this sutta has to say, the simile of the mountain. This happens at Savati. So then, in the middle of the day, King Pasenadi of Kosala approached the Blessed One. The The Blessed One said to him as he was sitting to one side, "Now where are you coming from, great king, in the middle of the day?" So just to start off there, King Pasenadi of Kosala, I'm sure you will probably all be familiar with King Pasenadi. He was probably the most powerful king in India at that time. He was ruling a very large kingdom called Kosala, which stretched from the Ganges River all the way up to the Himalaya mountains, and then from the east, the west rather, probably almost as far as where you find Delhi today, and then eastwards towards the Vajrayan Republic, where Vaisali was. And if you look on the map, it's a very large area, very large country. And that was probably the most powerful kingdom at that time. And then soon after that, it was Magadha that became very powerful soon afterwards. Magadha and Kosala were like the two big kingdoms. And soon afterwards, Magadha became the big empire in India, as we know, with King Ashoka, and before him, Chandragupta, etc. So, and King Pasenadi, the most powerful king at that day, he was a very ardent follower of the Buddha. So he would come to the Buddha at all kind of strange times. And when it says here, in the middle of the day, the point of that phrase is that the middle of the day is not the time you normally go to see the Buddha. You go maybe in the morning, you see him when he comes to, you know, offer alms or whatever, or you might come in the evening perhaps, when people usually come out and they have a Dhamma talk. But the middle of the day is like the wrong time to visit the Buddha. So the fact that he comes at that time means that there's something special, right? This is the purpose behind that phrase. So, then the Buddha, then he says to the Buddha, "Just now, venerable sir, I have been engaged in those affairs of kingship typical for head-anointed Kshatriya kings who are intoxicated with the intoxication of sovereignty, who are obsessed by greed for sensual pleasures, who have attained stable control in their country, and who rule having conquered a great sphere of territory on earth." So he's very honest. He says, you know, "I'm obsessed with sensual pleasures." What he's saying, basically, "I'm obsessed with sensual pleasures. And I am intoxicated by the intoxication of sovereignty." Sovereignty is like rulership, like it's like being the master, the head of a country. So you are intoxicated by these things. So he's basically despairing a little bit. You know, "I'm obsessed by all these things," basically saying to the Buddha, "What should I do?" And one of the interesting things here about this idea of intoxication is something that you see throughout the suttas, is being intoxicated by various things. Normally, when we think about intoxication, we think about drinking, right? And we all know that when you drink alcohol, it's very easy to lose your kind of self-control. You start doing all kind of silly things once you get drunk. But actually, it is not just alcohol that intoxicates you. It's many other things as well. And one of the things that according to King Pasenadi here that intoxicates you is power. He is intoxicated by the power of being the king in the large territory, right? And I think we can see that. You can see that people who become powerful, often they also become corrupt. Corruption and power often go hand in hand. That's one of the best reasons to have a democratic culture, is you can chuck them out once they start to get a bit corrupt, right? This is one of the nice things about democracy here. It's not so. Anyway, this is my personal opinion there, I should say here. So, but that is the case. That is just a way of power. It tends to corrupt. You know the old English saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely, right? So this is just the nature of that sort of situation. So you get intoxicated. That's what it means. You lose your sense of perspective. You lose your sense of what is right and wrong. It's like being drunk, basically. So that's power is one thing. Another thing the Buddha says is youth. You are youthful. When you are young, you think the world is mine, I can do what I like. You know, the body is very strong and fit. You can sort of mess around and you forget the consequences of your actions. You forget what is right and wrong. Again, it's the intoxication of being youthful. And this intoxication goes, you know, throughout life. Just being alive, just being a human being, intoxication of health, forgetting that you might get sick. All of these things are intoxications. So we have to be careful. And One of the reasons why we should do Marana Sati is precisely to remove some of those intoxications, to take away that poison in the mind which forgets what actually is important again. So this idea of intoxication is very broad in Buddhism. Madha is the Pali word for that. It means a lack of clarity about your priorities, basically. So then the Buddha replies, "What do you think, great king? Here a man would come to you from the east, one who is trustworthy and reliable. Having approached you, he would say, 'For sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the east, and there I saw a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king.' Then a second man would come to you from the west, a third man would come from the north, and a fourth man would come to you from the south, one who is trustworthy and reliable. Having approached you, he would say, 'For sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the south, and there I saw a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king. If, great king, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what should be done?' And King Pasenadi replies, 'If, venerable sir, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds?' The Buddha says, 'I inform you, great king, I announce to you, great king, aging and death, actually old age and death, are rolling in on you. When old age and death are rolling in on you, great king, what should be done? As old age and death are rolling in on me, venerable sir, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds?'" So, there you are. The death is like these great mountains coming from all the sides, crushing all living beings. And right now, as we sit here, you can imagine these enormous mountains coming from all sides, crushing all living beings, right? Moving in our direction, inexorably. One day, we are also going to be crushed by these mountains. And the thing is, you don't know how close the mountain is. Maybe the mountain is just behind you. Maybe it's right there. Maybe it is my turn tomorrow. I don't know. Maybe the mountain is there. You never know the state of your body, what can happen next. And of course, the idea of a great mountain, this is the truth for all living beings. We must all be crushed by old age and death sooner or later. So a very powerful reflection, the idea of the great mountain crushing all living beings. So, then King Pasenadi replies to that simile. He says, "There are, venerable sir, elephant battles fought by head-anointed Kattiya kings who are intoxicated with intoxication of sovereignty, who are obsessed by greed for sensual pleasures, who have attained stable control in the country, and who rule having conquered a great sphere of territory on earth. But there is no place for those elephant battles, no scope for them, when old age and death are rolling in. There are, venerable sirs, cavalry battles fought by head-anointed kings, chariot battles, infantry battles. But there is no place for those infantry battles, no scope for them, when old age and death are rolling in. In this court, venerable sir, there are counselors who, when the enemies arrive, are capable of dividing them by subterfuge. But there is no place for those battles of subterfuge, no scope for them, when old age and death are rolling in. In this royal court, venerable sir, there exists abundant bullion and gold stored in vaults and depositories. And with such wealth, we are capable of mollifying the enemies when they come. But there is no place for those battles of wealth, no scope for them when old age and death are rolling in. As old age and death are rolling in on me, Venerable Sir, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? So it is, Great King, so it is, Great King. As old age and death are rolling in on you, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? So you can see that, you know, the problem, of course, for a king, these are the kind of unwholesome things a king does. He gets into war and battles and all these kind of things. But of course, this is about all kinds of unwholesome deeds, right? There is no scope for them, because the mountain of death, the mountain of old age, can be anywhere, coming close very soon. I should say that the appropriate translation is not aging, and aging is not a very good translation. It's actually old age that is meant by, it's jara, right? Jara is actually old age and not aging. So So this then is the idea of marana sati, of remembering death. And again, there are a couple of places in the suttas where the Buddha explains in detail how we should do the marana sati practice. And one way of thinking is just to simply to remind ourselves that, you know, the idea of a mountain coming behind us. Well, what are those mountains in life? They are illness, right? We just don't know, you know, whether our heart is, you know, as good as it should be. Maybe it will fail one day. And this can happen even to young people, that the heart suddenly fails. There can be cancers in your body. You just don't know. Very often these things come as a surprise. This is one thing. Then there is all the accidents that happen in life. Traffic accidents is a classical one. So many thousands of people die in traffic accidents every year. And there is workplace accidents. There's all these possibilities of dying all the time around us. And sometimes we simply forget that. And the Buddha says, sometimes it's good just to remember these things. Just to remind yourself that it is ever-present. It is always, the chance is always there. And if your karma from a past life ripens in the wrong way, then again, you will die, you know, for a reason, maybe coming out of the blue. Suddenly you just die because the karma has ripened in that way. And we don't know what karma has in store for us. So these are always possibilities. Regardless of how careful you are, if the karma is wrong, then you have a problem. So that is the first thing, to actually make it real. Death can actually happen. And the second thing is to bring it as close to the present as possible. Not only is death real, not only can it happen next year or next week, it can happen very soon, right? We just don't know. And the more you can bring it into the present moment, the more powerful it becomes. And one of the suttas, the Buddha says, he asks all the monks, and he says to the monks, do you practice maranasati, recollection of death? And one monk says, yes, I practice maranasati. How do you practice maranasati? Oh, I think that, you know, I might die tomorrow. And the Buddha says, that's not good enough, or something like that. And then another monk says, oh, I think I might die this afternoon. And the Buddha says, that too is not good enough. Another one says, I might die at the end of the meal. Buddha says, not good enough. And then eventually one monk says, oh, I think that I might die after having eaten two or three spoonfuls of food. And then the Buddha says, now that is the kind of maranasati that works. And then eventually the monk who is the best one, he says that, well, I breathe in my out-breath. I reflect, I might die on the... If I breathe in, I might die on the out-breath. If I breathe out, I might die on the in-breath. And that is the kind of the ideal of maranasati. It's very hard to reach that point, but at least try to bring it a little bit forward in time, towards the present moment. Then it becomes a very powerful teaching. So as close as possible. So how can you do that? How can you actually realistically think of yourself as dying in the present moment, or very soon anyway? Let's say you start off thinking about dying tomorrow or next week, whatever feels comfortable for you. If you start to feel unpleasant, don't do it. Do only what feels natural and comfortable. But you try to bring it forward in time towards yourself. So how can you do that? And one of the things is always remind yourself, you're going to die anyway, right? So you might as well be prepared now. if you are not prepared now, then why will you be prepared when the situation actually happens? The only way to be prepared when death actually happens eventually is, in fact, to be prepared now. So remind yourself, I'm going to die. It's very nice to have a peaceful and nice death. So now is the time to be prepared for that. It's a simple reflection, but it sort of brings the reality home. Now is the time to be prepared. Not tomorrow, not next week, but now. So, those are some of the ways of making it real. The important point is to make it real, right? It can really happen. Sometimes you find, there was one person who said to me in the interview that he had felt he had some attachment to the body. He said that when he feels sick, he gets concerned, right? And that shows you, what that shows you is that the Maranasati hasn't really been very powerful. Because once you get sick and you then get concerned, it means that you haven't been able to make that sickness real before it actually happens. The idea is to make it real now, before it actually happens. So you bring that illness into consciousness now, as if it is happening right now. And then, when illness actually happens, then perhaps you won't be concerned, because it's already a reality for you in your mind. So if you do get concerned when you get sick, it shows you that the Maranasati hasn't been that strong here. It's difficult, of course, and it's very hard to do that, and it's very easy to say these things, but to actually do it is, of course, much more difficult. But it's worth a little bit of practice to try this kind of thing. Yeah. Anyway, I think that probably sums up the Maranasati quite well. And again, I want to emphasize that there are some people who feel uncomfortable with thinking about death, and that's fine. If you do feel uncomfortable, don't do it. Do other aspects of the Buddhist practice. But if you can do it, and you feel comfortable with this kind of reflection, then it is very useful. Okay, so Maranasati. I'm going to finish off the morning with one short sutta. And if you move forward about one sutta, and you come to a sutta called Fools and Wise Men, just after the next one. Majjhima Nikaya 129. And this is just a very short extract. And this is one of these other suttas. I have just picked it out simply because I like it. So I hope you... I'm sure that is makes it more interesting, I hope. So this is just about... So the purpose, the reason why I have chosen this particular sutta and why I want to read it out now, because we are dealing with purification here, right? Purifying the mind, purifying the body, purifying the speech. And this talks about some of the results of doing these kind of things. And it talks about the result in a very nice kind of way here. So I will read through the whole thing. The most important part is the last paragraph, but I will read man, a true man. I think it is a sapurisa, like a superior man, if you like. But because a wise man is one who thinks good thoughts, speaks good words, and does good deeds, the wise know him thus. This person is a wise man, a sapurisa, a superior man. So this is the definition of wisdom. But if wisdom is defined by goodness, it's quite nice, isn't it? A wise man feels pleasure and joy here and now in three ways. So this already a very important statement there, that you get pleasure and joy by being good, right? This is the kind of the importance of this. If a wise man is seated in an assembly or along a street or in a square and people there are discussing certain pertinent and relevant matters, then if the wise man is one who abstains from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct in sensual pleasures, from false speech, from wine, liquor, and intoxicants, which are the basis of heedlessness, the five precepts, right? He thinks, these people are discussing certain pertinent and relevant matters. Those things are not found in me, and I am not seen engaging in them. This is the first kind of pleasure and joy that the wise man feels right here and now. So the pertinent and relevant matters just means matters connected with the Dhamma, right? And it is said elsewhere in the suttas that when people discuss virtue, then the virtuous enjoy listening to that kind of talk. But if you are not virtuous and other people talk about virtue, you don't want to hear it because it feels uncomfortable, right? It doesn't feel nice. So the very fact that you want anybody who wants to listen to virtue is already somebody who has a degree of virtue in them, somebody who aspires to being kind, to be good. So that is the first one. You are happy when you realize that this is, you know, other people talk about this and you talk about these good things. And again, when a robber culprit is caught, a wise man sees kings having many kinds of torture inflicted on him. And there's a long list of various kinds of tortures, which are very quite interesting in some ways, they're quite gruesome in other ways, but they are, you see them in many places in the suttas. Then the wise man thinks thus, because of such evil actions as those, when a robber culprit is caught, kings have many kinds of tortures inflicted on him. Those things are not found in me, and I am not seen engaging in those things. This is the second kind of pleasure and joy that the wise man feels here and now. In other words, you're not afraid of the consequences of your bad actions. If you do bad things, you're kind of always looking over your shoulder, always afraid that somebody might catch you, right? And then you might have tortures or imprisonment or whatever happening to you because of that. You're free from that concern, free from that worry. And then comes the last part, which I like the most, and which I, one of the, sometimes you read the suttas and certain passages catch your eye because you find it resonates with you, right? It may not resonate with you in the same way. We all have different passages that resonate with us. This was one that resonated with me anyway. Again, when a wise man is on his chair or on his bed or resting on the ground, then the good actions that he did in the past, his good bodily, verbal and mental conduct, cover him, overspread him and envelop him, just as the shadow of a great mountain peak in the evening covers, spreads and envelops the earth, so too when a wise man is on his chair or on his bed and or resting on the ground, then the good actions that he did in the past, his good verbal, bodily and mental conduct cover him, overspread him and envelop him. Then the wise man thinks, I have not done what is evil. I have not done what is cruel. I have not done what is wicked. I have done what is good. I have done what is wholesome. I have made myself a shelter from anguish. When I pass away, I shall go to the destination of those who have not done what is evil. Who have made themselves a shelter from anguish. He does not sorrow, grieve and lament. He does not weep, beating his breast or become distraught. This is the third kind of pleasure and joy that the wise man feels here and now. So the idea here is that if you are a good person, if you purify yourself, you don't even have to remember those good acts so much. Just when you come back home after a long day and you sit down and you rest on your chair or rest in your bed, all that goodness comes back to you and you feel a sense of gladness in your heart. It's automatic, right? And that is why also when you meditate, if you do the breath meditation and you start to become peaceful, then the goodness from the past tends to come back to you almost automatically because of that purity. And then the gladness arises inside of you. So if that doesn't happen, it means that we need to do more, we need to purify more to allow the gladness to arise inside of us. It's this idea of being completely surrounded by goodness, like the shadow of the mountain spreading, enveloping the ground in the same way. We become covered, enveloped in our own good actions and goodness. It's not a selfish kind of idea. It's not you think, I am good. It's just a natural good feeling that happens when you do what is good. That is what happens. And sometimes, of course, we aid that a little bit by trying to reflect about these things in the past, but often it just happens by itself. Then, the very last one for the fools and the wise man is the wise man who has given himself over to good conduct of body, speech and mind on the dissolution of the body after death. He reappears in heaven in a happy destination, even in heaven. So that is the last one. But for us, when we are trying to meditate, it is the middle one there, which perhaps is the most important one. The fact that this gives us a sense of joy and happiness. Okay, so that is all for this morning, and we will continue again this afternoon. So let us pay our respects together to the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha.